From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, a new public policy forum report on the health of Milwaukee's nonprofits finds the sector is growing and revenues are increasing, but individual organizations are downsizing. Then, two pieces of evidence tell us that one of the stars visible to the naked eye is a stranger in our midst.
This one came from elsewhere. That means that you can look up at a really bright star. Arcturus is really bright and pretty. And you're looking at a piece of another galaxy.
The Postcards from America exhibit at Milwaukee Art Museum is the work of 11 photographers.
It's interesting for them because it's a new way of working. You know, they really only have 2 weeks. They get to dive in and they sort of riff off each other. And so it's a way to encourage experimentation.
And we'll have an in-studio performance from Milwaukee musician Miles Coyne. Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Last week, Milwaukee's Nonpartisan Public Policy Forum released its newest report. Under the microscope this time was the health of the area's nonprofit sector. The report looked at levels of growth, both in terms of numbers of not-for-profit organizations, as well as trends in contributions and revenues. The good news is that the sector has expanded significantly in the past 25 years, as has philanthropic giving. The not-so-good news is that there appears to be an opposite trend toward diminishing capacity and viability for individual organizations. Philip Laper is the forum's 2013-14 Norman N. Gill Fellow, and he's the lead author of the report. Rob Hagen is the president of the forum, and they both join me in the studio now. Gentlemen, welcome to Lake Effect.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
What were you trying to accomplish with this study?
Originally, I wanted to look at what's happening in the nonprofit sector. I came to the Public Policy Forum from philanthropy, and we knew that philanthropy in the nonprofit sector was growing, but organizations were still struggling. So I wanted to take a look at maybe why that is. And I wanted to examine how charitable giving responds to the economic environment. We just came through the Great Recession. We know that the economy is still kind of unsteady a little bit. So I wanted to see how that was affecting nonprofits.
So what did you find? What were some of the overall things that came out of the research?
Well, we found really positive things and also some things that may be concerning. One of the great things we found is that the nonprofit sector in Milwaukee is growing. We have more contributions. We have total revenue is increasing considerably. So that's great. We're supporting these organizations. We're getting more organizations as well. So we have more diversity. Whereas in 1989, for example, maybe we had one organization for minority business owners. Now we have separate ones for Latino business owners, African Americans, women, LGBT business owners. So we're seeing more diversity that way. The concerning element of this is that organizations are getting smaller. So even though we have more money to fund them, we just have so many more organizations that what everyone ends up getting is a little bit less than they used to.
Is there a problem that things are getting so splintered?
There could be. And we identify that there likely are certain ramifications that we need to address. I'll start with the positive. One thing about organizations being small is that we're increasing competition, right? As an economist, which is what I'm trained to do, I like competition. I think that's great. It promotes efficiency. It promotes building capacity. So there are good things there. But the problem with being small is that some organizations just need to be big, right? You can't have a homeless shelter with 3 beds. You need one with 50 or 100 or even more. And so as organizations get small, their capacity is going down individually. So some of the larger programs that simply require a large entity to administer them, those may be threatened by these trends.
And Bonnie, I can add a perspective both as a former county health and human services director and also as a president of a nonprofit myself. I can give you two responses to that. Number one, I think when you look in the social services realm, for some of these programs, for sophisticated mental health services and disability services and so on, you do need a certain level of expertise and level of capacity for the nonprofit sector to take on these programs. So to the extent that we have greater numbers of smaller organizations, I'm not saying it's absolutely a problem, but it's something something that if indeed government is looking to turn more to the community-based organizations to provide sets of services, the question becomes, is there the level of skill and the level of capacity to do that for government if it should need that to happen? From the perspective of a nonprofit administrator, I will say that this also creates issues in that to the extent that we have more organizations, it means that we have more pressure for fund development. We have more pressure for communications. And so an argument could potentially be made that we are seeing the resources that are being raised devoted more to those types of activities as opposed to direct service provision or direct mission-based activities.
Exactly. I was going to say a lot of people would complain that it's going into the overhead rather than the actual service that's supposed to be provided.
And that's a threat. And does that necessarily mean that having a greater number is wrong? No, but maybe it does mean that perhaps we should look to see more collaboration in areas like fund development and PR and human resources and back office functions among nonprofits so that they can spread out those costs.
When you looked at the numbers in terms of giving and you were saying things look good, there's a huge increase in donations that people are making to nonprofits. What are some of the things that have affected that both positively and negatively? Are we looking at a continued increase?
Yeah, we seem to be so. So since 1989, contributions have actually grown at twice the rate of the overall economy. Nationally, people give about 2.2% of their overall income to nonprofits in the form of contributions. In Wisconsin, it's 1.7%. So we're a little below the national average, but we've been growing and it seems like we will continue to grow. One of the really interesting findings of the report is that it's not necessarily cash income that drives contributions. So we can see through some kind of statistical analysis that when income goes up, people contribute more of their income. Nothing surprising there. But when we look at asset prices, we also find that those drive charitable contributions. So for example, if your stock portfolio goes up, if the value of your 401k increases, if your home property values go up, you're actually willing to give more money because you expect to have more in the future. Right? You don't have any more cash today, but you expect to at some point later. But the reverse is also true. So even if those property values go down or your assets go down, you don't lose any cash per se, but you're going to start reeling in your contributions.
And one of the things I found most interesting is that one of the negative effects was increased income taxes, both on the state and federal level, but property taxes didn't seem to have a negative effect. And I found that really interesting. I don't know why that would be.
Yeah, so there are a number of reasons for that. And one is that property tax data, you kind of have to work with it a little bit. So at some point, you might lose something there. But I don't think that's the case here. What I would say is that donors respond better to property tax increases as opposed to income tax increases in terms of what they do with their donations. We also see them differently, right? A lot of times property taxes come attached to your mortgage. So they're relatively invisible. And the sum of what you're paying for your house, property taxes may not be that influential at the end of the month when you're writing that check. Another reason is that people may be more willing to pay property taxes because they see the benefits of that, right? They see that going to their parks. They see that going to their schools. And so they are willing to tolerate an increase without necessarily cutting back in other certain areas because they see the benefit that's coming from it.
Well, what are the policy implications of this report? What should government be doing in response to this? What should nonprofits be doing and thinking about?
We identify the likely outcomes, right, based on the data that's available. To say, you know, X, Y, and Z is going to happen is just something that's relatively impossible given the data that we have. But what we're starting to do here is start the conversation, say, maybe this is the data that we need to get at. Some of the likely implications is that services are going to continue being cut at the nonprofit level. There was an independent survey, it wasn't done with the Public Policy Forum, that found in 2011, 38% of nonprofits plan to reduce their services, right? Which is at odds with the fact that the sector is growing, but we're actually losing some services. And so when government seeks to turn to the nonprofit sector, either maybe to pick up some slack where you can't find budget funding, or to administer public services, there's this question of, is anyone going to be available with the capacity and the expertise and the relationships within the community to be able to do those things?
Does that say that government should be thinking about taking back some of the services that it's looking to nonprofits to fill?
I'm not sure that it's saying that, Bonnie. I think what it is saying, and I think the most tangible example is the conversation we're having community-wide about arts and culture. So the Public Policy Forum, and you've had us on the show, we have detailed the need of the Milwaukee County-owned cultural institutions, and that need is immense. What I think this research is suggesting is that we need to be thinking about the capacity of local philanthropy to help meet that need, regardless of what we do in terms of enhanced public funding. And we may do nothing at all. But even if we do something, even if there is some type of a new tax to help support the cultural institutions, I think that our finding is that the need is so great that, local philanthropy is going to have to step up in some way. And so what does the fact that there are so many additional organizations out there that they're supporting and that we have so many nonprofits in this community, what does that say about the willingness of local foundations and other charitable givers to step up and support this one group of assets? So it's something that certainly county government needs to be aware of. If the hope is that friends groups are going to step up and that private donors are going to step up to help fill some of that need, we're not saying that that's not possible, but I think this research is suggesting that's something we need to look at a little more carefully.
I was going to say, it looks to me that the donor pool is being stretched pretty thin. You know, we can't look to people with deep pockets for every need that needs to be filled in the nonprofit sector. Would it help to consolidate some of these? Is the research suggesting that?
Not directly. I mean, I think consolidation kind of carries a lot of baggage with it. And certainly the report does not argue that nonprofits should merge together completely. What it's saying is that there may be some role for collaboration, for cooperation, whether that takes the form of simple partnerships, almost these joint task force, or whether it takes the form of complete mergers, isn't really a question that we address. It's a conversation that we should be having. The report's implications say we should be starting this conversation both within the philanthropic community, at the level of local government, and even at households. But it doesn't say consolidation is great or consolidation is bad.
Well, then what is the takeaway message here, that we should continue the conversation?
Yes, absolutely. So these trends are going to continue. For example, if you wanted to fund the average organization in Milwaukee at its level in 1989, you would need an extra $500 million within the nonprofit sector within the four-county area. That's just simply not going to happen. And these trends seem like they're going to continue. The sector's going to continue to grow. Organizations are actually going to continue to get a little bit smaller. And so we can see what the implications may be, and we need to start having that conversation. So this is really more of a springboard, right? We can talk about collaboration. We can talk about consolidation and talk about the benefits of both, or how we might address these trends to make sure that we're not losing services or nonprofits that are helping populations that we really want to support.
And the thing that this research does not examine is the changing face of philanthropy in this region. And that is actually a topic that the Public Policy Forum is currently researching. We know that we have several foundations in this town that are either sunsetting very soon or think they're going to sunset in the next 5 to 10 years. We have some very prominent local philanthropists who are getting on in age. And so there is a question mark. What is the ability of the next generation of philanthropic leaders to step in and to fill those gaps? To the extent that we also do have some new foundations emerging, are they going to be giving in areas that are similar to those that are sunsetting? So that's a very important set of questions in the areas of social services, arts and culture, education, you name it. And so that is meritorious of further research, and the Public Policy Forum does hope to examine some of those ideas and illuminate the community on those issues with some research that will be released later this year.
Philip and Rob, thank you so much for coming in this morning.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Philip Laper is the Public Policy Forum's 2013-14 Norman N. Gill Fellow. He's the lead author of the report on the health of Milwaukee's nonprofit sector, a link to which can be found on our website, wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Rob Henkin is the forum's president. Stay tuned. Astronomy contributor Gene Creighton joins us in just a moment to talk about what stars and constellations are visible to us in the night sky. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio.
Welcome back to Lake Effect. It is great to have you here. I'm Bonnie North, along with Jean Creighton, our astronomy contributor. Hello, Jean.
Hello, Bonnie.
It is so great to see you. And, you know, I love summer for all kinds of reasons. I love to go swimming. I love to eat ice cream. I just like being out on my bike, all of those things. But one of the great things, and we haven't talked about this in a while, is getting to look at the night sky and seeing what's out there because it's warm enough to be outside.
Indeed.
And so I thought this is a perfect time. We haven't talked about what you can see when you look up in a long time. So let's do that. What is visible right about now if you were so inclined to go out with binoculars or a telescope?
Or even your naked eyes, right?
Okay.
Even without any help at all.
Oh, let's start with naked eyes then.
There are some bright things in the night sky that we can find thanks to the Big Dipper. So the Big Dipper is pretty high now in the sky, and we know the Big Dipper looks like a shopping cart with a long, curvy handle, as I like to describe it. And if you imagine the front of the shopping cart, there are two stars called the pointer stars. And if you put at arm's length two fingers between those pointer stars and move them toward the opening of the shopping cart five times, you get the North Star. And the North Star, of course, is going to show you north, and that'll help you get oriented. And I only mention this because some people have a little compass built in their bodies and they know where north is by themselves, but of course, a whole lot of us don't. And it's useful to have some clues to orient yourself.
Okay.
Now, when we're looking in the north, we're going to see the Big Dipper. Those of us who go to bed reasonably early will probably have a hard time seeing Cassiopeia, the W or M, just because she's so low in the sky. But that does mean that the Big Dipper is very high and convenient. On the other part of the sky in the south is where we have the more seasonal objects in the sky. So I'm going to go follow the tail of the Big Dipper. It is kind of in the southern part of the sky, so the expression that I want you to repeat mentally or even out loud is this, arc to Arcturus. Would you please model that for our,
certainly,
for our audience?
Arc to Arcturus.
And spy Spica.
And spy Spica.
Excellent. And the sillier you say it, the better, because that's how we'll remember it better. So arc to Arcturus and spy Spica. Now, this little saying has bought you two constellations for free. The star Arcturus is a foreign star, an alien star, and everybody gets intrigued when I say that. But of course, it's a star that grew up outside our Milky Way. And this is not true. Every star you can see without a telescope is certainly a product of the Milky Way. But when we analyze the light from Arcturus, we see that it's going way too fast. If it was born in the Milky Way at the speed it's going, it would have left a long time ago. So we understand that this star must have been grabbed by a little galaxy coming too close to us. Thanks to gravity, we took most of its stars, maybe all of them, and a lot of its gas and dust. The other reason we suspect that this star did not grow up in the Milky Way is that if we look at the ratios of different isotopes. So those are elements that have the same elements, say hydrogen and hydrogen, but have different numbers of neutrons in their nucleus. So those ratios are pretty fixed, and that's one way we know if something, say, came from the Earth or came from Mars, because their ratios would be different. These are completely different than anything we see in the Milky Way. So those two pieces of evidence that it's going too fast and the isotope ratios are different tell us this one came from elsewhere.
Oh, that's so exciting.
It is, because that means that you can look up at a really bright star. Arcturus is really bright and pretty. And you're looking at a piece of another galaxy. Isn't that awesome?
That's fantastic.
Awesome.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Now, for those people in the audience who are Harry Potter fans, they might think that Arcturus sounds familiar. It is the middle name of Regulus Arcturus Black, Sirius Black's brother. So anyway, that's a little tidbit for the Harry Potter fans in our midst. And I'll carry on to talk a little bit about Spica, the brightest star in Virgo. Virgo is supposed to be a young woman, but I have never saw a young woman there. I see a squished box. And Not
as romantic to say that it's a squished box.
Perhaps I think not, yeah. But people never forget that. They love the squished box. So we're looking at a rectangle, and I like to tell people that pretend it's just a package that's being delivered, and unfortunately the package fell down. So one of its four corners got kicked in, and what we're left with looks a lot like a trapezium. That is the shape of Virgo. Now, both Arcturus and Spike are bright enough that you will definitely see them in the city, even in downtown. But if you are lucky enough to live fairly far from city lights, then you should really be able to see the little trapezium I described for Virgo. And if your eyes are keen, you should be able to see it in a city's landscape as long as you're not facing lights.
So we've arced Arcturus, we've spied Spica. Now what's next?
Next is we're going to find the most important hero in Greek mythology.
Well, that can only be one man.
Yes.
And
who is he?
Hercules.
Yes.
Yes.
Now I have to confess that a few years ago, my mother had on her shelf six books. It was part of a series, a Greek mythology encyclopedia. And I said to her, Mommy, I need to liberate this. I obviously have more use for it than you do. So she let me ship it off to Milwaukee, and I have it now. Of these six books, there's one on the gods, one on various heroes, how the universe came to be, various other things. There's one book that's dedicated to Hercules. There are so many stories about Hercules himself. What's convenient is that Hercules is close to the Northern Crown. And I say that because Hercules kind of looks like a kite, which is unfortunate because if you look up, you'll see all kinds of things that look like kites. It's pretty hopeless. But near Hercules, there is a very nice symmetrical C letter like Charlie, and it points to Hercules. So the lower part of the C points to what we would call kind of the head of Hercules, and the lower part of the C points to his torso. It makes for a strange person. There's a small head, very long neck, and this weird kite-shaped chest. But if you look at it upside down, then the kite could be a kite, and the rest of it could be a nice tail. So that is Hercules and the Northern Crown. And of course, as the summer progresses, we get to see more and more of the summer triangle, which is one of my favorite things because I do love summer. And we get to keep looking at it until November. So we keep that little taste of flavor all until the end of November. Very bright stars there. Vega is the brightest of the three. Vega is part of Lyra. There is Deneb, which is part of Cygnus. Cygnus is also known as the Northern Cross. And if you imagine it to be like a cross, it kind of flies along the Milky Way. And the third star is called Altair as part of the constellation of the Eagle. So those three stars, even though they belong to three different constellations, together they make that summer triangle that straddles the Milky Way.
And just a lot of wonderful stuff to look at in the night sky.
Indeed. And all I would say is make sure that if you are going to spend some time outside, it is going to feel colder after a while when you're still. And of course, you don't want to provide meals for mosquitoes. So you'll need to bring some bug repellent.
Bug repellent and maybe a nice sleeping bag to kind of wrap around you.
That's right.
All right. Well, I'll let you know what I see.
Great. Thanks.
Thanks, Jean. Lake Effect contributor Jean Creighton is the director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium, which is located on the campus of the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee. After almost a year of work, the Postcards from America Milwaukee edition is up at the Milwaukee Art Museum. We'll talk with photography curator Lisa Sutcliffe next on Lake Effect. You are listening to us on WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for joining us this morning. For the past year and a half, a group of photographers from the photographic cooperative Magnum Photos has fanned out across America. The project, called Postcards from America, aims to capture the essence of specific places across the country from multiple points of view. Well, the latest subject of the project is Wisconsin, and 11 photographers took part over the last year. An exhibition based on all of their work opened last week at the Milwaukee Art Museum, and I joined photography curator Lisa Sutcliffe in the gallery for a first look. Lisa, thank you so much for taking time to talk with us on Lake Effect. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Bonnie. Looking forward to it.
Well, we are standing here in the middle of the exhibition, and before we get to talking about specific pieces, tell me about the genesis of the project.
Sure. This was a project called Postcards from America that began in 2011 when a group of Magnum photographers decided to think a little bit about collectivity and photography and how they might work together to travel around the country and make pictures. So when I first moved here last year, Martin Parr was here shooting for another commission, and we started talking and decided that Milwaukee might make the perfect next stop for their project. So around March of last year, I started talking to the artists, and they started thinking about what they might want to photograph when they came. And in August, we had three photographers join us, Martin Parr, Bruce Gilden, and Susan Mizellis. Then in January, Donovan Wiley, Jacobo Sobel, and Alessandra Sanguinetti came to visit. And then wrapping up the project in April were Alex Soth, Jim Goldberg, Zoe Strauss, Paolo Pellegrin, Mark Power, and Susan Mizellis came back again.
So now that the exhibition is complete, before we get into what we think of it, how do the photographers feel about the project? This was their third?
Fifth in a series. And, you know, photographers rotate in and out, so some of them, this was their first time working, and for some have been involved the entire five times. You know, I think it's interesting for them because it's a new way of working. You know, they really only have 2 weeks. They get to dive in and they sort of riff off each other. And so it's a way to encourage experimentation. So they're not always sure what they're going to get, but I think that the pressure of it makes them competitive with each other as well. And then, you know, they're really excited with what they see that each other doing.
People were looking at different things around Milwaukee. How did they choose? Did they get to choose what they wanted to do and then clear it with the group, or did people fight over certain subjects?
No, they work completely independently. And this isn't a documentary project where they decided they wanted to come and define Milwaukee. It's much more experimental than that. For them, it's about how it connects to what they do elsewhere in the world. So you wouldn't be surprised that someone like Jim Goldberg would come in and be interested in working with Polaroids and having people write on them and interested in underserved populations. The same with Mark Power. He's really been interested in architecture and in these kind of boundary lines in communities wherever he's worked. Martin Parr with leisure activities. So you see their work connecting to the work they've done elsewhere. And in that way, it's kind of interesting to think about how 11 different people might respond to a place.
Well, you mentioned the Polaroids, and we happen to be standing right in front of Jim Goldberg's pieces, and they are wonderful.
They're fantastic. I really am excited about this work. You know, Jim Goldberg is an artist I've worked with multiple times in the past, and I really am excited about what he does as an artist. One of his signatures is working with the Polaroid, which is a very intimate, sort of small, 3x4-inch photograph, which he then can give back to the people he's photographing so they get copies of the work as he's going. And then he talks to them a little bit, and he asks them to write something about themselves on the photograph. And in Milwaukee, he was looking for Milwaukee's best, which is, of course, a subjective term. So, in fact, he's looking at students. He's looking at people who have interesting stories, the best kielbasa maker in Milwaukee, and just the fact that we all are very special, very talented at something. So looking for these unsung heroes in our community.
So when he came into and this would be true for any of the photographers, how did they find their way into, was it their responsibility to get into the communities themselves, or did you end up like smoothing any ground ahead of time?
Well, there was quite a bit of work that went into it. And actually, one of the things that most excites me about this kind of project is that it's a collaborative project with the community. So UWM and MIAD created a class that had students who would work as assistants to the photographers, apprentice with them, do research for them. We had a field producer in town. I reached out to a lot of different people. So there was a lot of ways in which we helped to connect them to the community. They often did a lot of research on their own to tell us who they wanted to meet.
And one of the things I like so much about Jim's project is that it is something that really does point to an intimate connection with the community, whereas some of the pictures, you know, could have been made anywhere. These are definitely unique to Milwaukee.
Right. There are some of them, and turning around, I think this is Donovan's?
Donovan Wiley.
Yeah. Those are very much, you know, about architecture of space.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And mm-hmm. so it is, if you know Milwaukee, you know it's Milwaukee.
Mm-hmm. But they could be highways anywhere in the country to some degree. He's interested in the way our highways become a machine, that they are this construction that suggests a manifest destiny, that we build these highway constructions so that we can more easily connect with each other, but they also become barriers.
This is the one centerpiece, and if we can move a little toward it, one of the things that I like about it is it seems very empty, except there's that one vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So this was a really fun picture to make. Donovan wanted to be able to get up high, so he rented a U-Haul and had an assistant, and he and his assistant climbed onto it and were sort of trying to figure out a way to get the right angle. And, of course, we did it in the middle of the day at a time when there weren't people parked underneath. But he did move around in order to get that really sparse feeling. And there is this central column that goes up through the photograph that gives you that feeling of almost like a beacon, like if you build it, they will come. It feels a little bit like a cathedral. There are many different layers in this photograph.
All right, let's move to something else. Who's over here in the corner?
So in the corner, we have Susan Mizellis, who was interested in factories in Milwaukee. We have such a rich industrial history, but it's also changed quite a bit recently. So she was interested in also the lives of women. That's something that she's been interested in since the 1970s. So she went to different factories, Harley Davidson, Johnsonville Farms, Sherline. She met with the women who worked there, took their pictures, and then asked them to write a little bit about their experience working in factories. And then those pictures are contrasted with the objects that they make that are often quite large and unrecognizable. So you have a very human element and then this thing that is still made that is unrecognizable.
As people have been going through this and you've been getting audience reaction to mm-hmm. it, how are people liking to seeing their city through these particular lenses?
Well, the show just opened last week, so I am really looking forward to hearing what everyone thinks. You know, it's almost as if the pictures are a little bit more about the artists than it is about the city itself, but for me it was a really exciting way to get to know people in Milwaukee and how it connects together as a city.
Yeah, and it also, I would think, gives an opportunity for, yes, it's about the photographers, but it's, you know, we're seeing it through their
an
interpretation.
An outsider's lens.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
How do you think this part of this project is going to fit into the international scope of this project? And where is it going to put the Milwaukee Art Museum in terms of future photographic exhibitions?
Well, that's something that I was really excited about because they have been through the American Southwest, Utah, Rochester, New York, Florida, and of course there will be Milwaukee, and they're going to continue to go to a number of places. So when they have a final exhibition, it'll be interesting to see how these different places around the country contrast with each other, or if they do, or if you see that Bruce Gilden looks very similar everywhere he goes. But it'll be exciting to have Milwaukee as a part of this final exhibition, which will likely tour the country. And I think, you know, photography's always been a really important part of the Milwaukee Art Museum, but starting next year, we're going to have an entire floor dedicated to photography and video, so this is going to be a place that is on the map for photography, and that's something that I'm really excited about.
Well, take me to one last piece, so that, and I'm asking you, like, to pick your favorite child, but...
Well, I won't say it's a favorite, but I really want to highlight Alessandra Sanguinetti's work from Black River Falls. This show is not just about Milwaukee, but about Wisconsin, and Wisconsin Death Trip is a really important cultural artifact that looms large in our cultural understanding of the state. So she was drawing on this archive of pictures by Charles Van Schaik from the turn of the century in Black River Falls and made these photographs in that rural town now that have this element of the 19th century to them, but with this kind of more contemporary custom so that there's a little bit of tension in the pictures. And what she said about them was that when she went to make the photographs, you know, of school children, of dairy farm workers, that she meant to take the photograph that would be the last photograph of them ever. So they have this kind of gravitas to them as well.
The larger one of the little girl is particularly striking.
Yeah, everyone loves that picture, and I'm delighted that that will be part of our collection, so we'll be able to continue to show it. But she just has this sort of magical quality to her, like she's been pulled out of time through the clothes that she's wearing, through her hairstyle, and through this very contemplative look on her face.
It's a beautiful expression that she captured.
Yeah. Alessandra's very talented in working with young people, and that's something she's done in the past. And there's an element of magic to all of these pictures. She really is able to sort of give you the sense of a fable or of a story being written, which I think is really special.
Well, and of course, the last one that we have time to talk about is this wonderful one of the woman laughing, which I think you're using as a cover image. And you want to know the story behind that. Whatever she's laughing, it's obviously it's a full belly, the head thrown back laugh, and you absolutely want to know what's going on.
Yeah, this picture is by Alex Soth, and he was interested in the American movie by our own Milwaukee filmmaker Chris Smith. So he interviews and works with some students at a casting call at UWM. But then this portrait of Mary is this great moment where she's caught mid-laugh, and it's just infectious. You really want to find out what she thinks is so entertaining.
Well, Lisa, thank you so much for taking time and showing us a little bit. There's so much more to see that we didn't have time to talk about, but thank you so much.
Thank you, Bonnie.
Lisa Sutcliffe is the curator of photography at the Milwaukee Art Museum. The Postcards from America Milwaukee edition is the work of 11 Magnum photographers who visited Wisconsin between last August and this April. The exhibit is on view in the Contemporary Galleries through mid-October, and there is a link to more information from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. We'll take one last break and then return with an in-studio performance by Milwaukee-based musician Miles Coyne. Stay tuned for that on Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio.
Think about it to get through the day, to find some money, to find a way.
Welcome back to Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Musician Miles Coyne was obsessed with comic books when he was growing up in Escanaba, Michigan, feasting on the creativity of the images. Music came a little later when Coyne and his family moved to Green Bay while he was in high school. He became friends with fellow students who were in a band and never looked back. Today, Coyne lives here in Milwaukee and is involved with many bands in the River West community. He finds that collaboration with other musicians is key to learning, growing, making music, and to creating family. Coyne recently chatted with WUWM at Night's Eleanor Peterson, and we're now hearing his song, Minotaur.
Always wanted to be. It's a lonely way. When you aim for the best, when you retrace your steps, you will learn from the past. With a battle axe, I'm coming back for more.
Miles Coyne, welcome to WUWM.
Hello. Yes, thanks for having me.
We just heard Minotaur. What was the inspiration behind Minotaur?
I was sitting at home watching a lot of The Shining. There's this weird movie on Netflix that kind of goes into the conspiracy theorists of that movie. It's totally insane, but I kind of got lost in watching that movie, and I was going through a period where I was just trying to do something different with the music and the band and I was growing up a little bit. So I was thinking a lot about when you kind of learn a lot from your past. And that kind of happens in that movie a lot, really. In the subtle themes of The Shining, that's going on. I realized what I was going through was going through in this movie. And there's a lot of imagery in the movie I kind of borrowed from. There's my experience in the song, but I really like in the movie, you know, the kid's running from his dad, and he's in the maze, and there's at the end he escapes him by walking backwards through his footsteps, and that was something I thought was a really cool image. And, you know, I kind of sing about having a battle axe and coming back for more. Whereas in the movie, that's a little bit more murderous. Mine's supposed to be a little bit more triumphant. Like, it's a battle. It's a good thing. You know, like, the door is you as a person. You're trying to get through a challenge like that.
So it's not really mythological as, like, the Minotaur is.
Well, in that movie, he's kind of like a Minotaur. He's running around, and there's a lot of subtle things I couldn't get. You know, he's got those huge eyebrows. He's just like, and he gets all mad. So that's kind of where that comes from. I'm sort of making fun of Jack Nicholson and myself.
I wish the listeners could have seen that facial expression.
Just imagine, do a face yourself, listeners.
You're originally from the UP. How did you end up in Milwaukee, and how does the music scene compare to the one back home?
Oh, my goodness. When I was in the UP, I was just, like, living with my family, you know, with my mom next to my grandma and my grandfather. And so there wasn't much music. I mean, I had piano teachers, and I was doing that stuff, but I was more stuck in comic books then. It wasn't until after, you know, we moved to, like, Green Bay for high school, and then that's when I kind of met a bunch of my friends in the band Temple, Jamie and Cassidy, and later Larkin. That was the band I've been in the longest, and that's when, in high school, that's kind of when that took over. I used to be like a comic book nerd, but it just turned into a band nerd. It's the same thing, essentially, really. So yeah, it was kind of like in Green Bay. But yeah, when I moved here after going to school in Madison, just because we thought there was kind of like a weird punky community here, and there totally was, with a bunch of house shows, and there's so much more we discovered, you know, all the indie bands and all the huge festivals. And so I would say that, I mean, out of anywhere, I really love Milwaukee's music scene.
You've established yourself in Milwaukee, particularly in River West, Brady Street, Locust Street. What is it about Milwaukee that attracts musicians like yourself and like your bands, the Rusty Nickel Band and Ladder? What is it about that part of the city that draws that attention from musicians and to musicians?
I think it's an evolution of what's going on. There's like venues in there like Lineman's, you know, great places that have existed for a long time. And then there's just people like me and all my friends, you know, graduating college. I mean, I graduated college a while ago, but there's a lot of people moving to town that are songwriters that have, like, my friends, like the Ugly Brothers. They lived in Madison. It's like, you guys should come here. And then they move here, and then we all go to Lineman's, and we're just kind of like, look at this moment. So I feel like, I think the city just has a lot there that people, you know, there's a lot of great venues and stuff.
In the album you released last August titled Take Things As They Come, you dedicate the album to three women because they make up your home. You know, going through your albums and going through your work, I'm realizing, is there an underlying theme throughout your work about home or belonging somewhere?
On that record, yes, definitely. That's kind of like the coming-of-age record. I'd made a few records before that were just me just trying to figure it out, but that was the one where I had a lyrical idea what I was trying to express. When my grandmother passed away, it was a very hard thing for my mother, who, I mean, and me and myself and everyone in the family, you know, and a lot of the grandkids kind of there a lot, so... So yeah, I was just kind of going through that, kind of realizing that this is the moment. I mean, and still, that's still there. That journey's still there. So that's kind of like the initial leap of the journey of life. But yeah, so there is an underlying theme of trying to express what can I do with the time I have to, like, make the family proud. There's a fun little journey there in my head, like, what am I going to do with my next 10 years of my life? So I try to do a lot of fun stuff, with that being said.
Addictedness of you, well, I'm this fool, how I only play the game. What I find strange is you see me when you hallucinate. Well, turkey burgers, salad, piece of fruit, I bag up cashews, well, it's just cranberry juice. Anyway, you see me when you hallucinate. And everything today that I hate, I don't find it hard that you couldn't keep a job pursuing all human dreams. You won't get bored with making a fortune if it's easier than it seems. Oh, sure, she did it up for you. So the landlords ain't got zip to do. But what I find strange is it happens on your payday lately. I don't find it weird you don't find a career pursuing all Truman dreams. You won't get bored with making a fortune if it's easier than it seems.
which is easier than it seems. Green cheese, string cheese, butter toast with honey, one banana, chocolate cherry sundae. Anyway, you see me when you hallucinate. And I don't mind that it's never quite enough. And Robitussin isn't for your brains, but I find strange is the feeling it's supposed to create. The way that bugs and beetles behave, the atoms in your room rearrange, the boogie board riding away at the distance that you're moving away. But you see me when you hallucinate. You see me when you hallucinate.
On the album Song by Rusty Nickel is mostly written by you, but with the exception of one by Kaylee Conway, and we just heard another one of her songs, The Volcano Song, what kind of stories do you aim to tell in your songs when you're writing?
With Take Things As They Come, I'm definitely trying to like give this image of my sort of journey of life, kind of figuring out what I'm doing, you know, early 20s vibe. But with the Kaylee song being on there, I really liked, we borrow her ideas of themes and kind of feature it in there. Because at the same time, me and my friends are playing a ton of bands together. You know, like Kaylee and the drummer at the time who's in the band, they have their own band now called Kaylee Conway and the Lucy Cukes. There's a sense of community in our friend group where we like to play shows together and have friends playing each other's songs. So with About being on the record, I was trying to borrow the lyrical themes, just sort of, because she's singing about a man, you know, so it sort of takes you out of the context of me singing. You know, I was just cool with, hey, Kaylee, just throw a song on there. I love that. I love that song, you know. So, yeah, there's kind of like two ideas there.
Do you prefer playing and singing solo, or do you like the collaboration with being in the groups and performing with other musicians and taking other groups' works? Like, what is the venue that you prefer working in the most?
That's something I still try to discover. I really love having the band because I really like having people that are just positive. And, you know, if I freak out and have a bad day, the mandolin player, Jordan's just going to be like, hey, like, don't do that. And it'll, like, calm me down. You know, the family is a huge thing. Lately, we have different people in the band. We have a different guitar player and an optional drummer friend that play with us. So that's really cool. And then when I play solo, I get the experience to just kind of, like, work on my singing. And I can sing really good with the band, but I feel like sometimes in the band's there, I get a little distracted. So there's, like, props to both. You know, a lot of my favorite songwriters do that, too, where they play solo or they play with the whole band. And I like to strive for that.
With the name of your band, the current one that we're talking about, because you're re-releasing your album, Take Things As They Come, with your band Miles Coyne and the Rusty Nickel Band, why is it a Rusty Nickel? What image are you trying to portray with that adjective and that particular coin?
I mean, when we originally thought of the name, my friend Cassidy came up with it as a joke. And I was like, I really love Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band and names that are just ridiculous from the 60s that just make no sense. I would love to have one of those. And I don't think the name has any of that funny 60s shine to it at all. But it was like, oh, Coyne, Nickel, there's five band members. That's funny. And it was just like immediately like, that's totally it.
Then what genre would you label yourself as by yourself when with your bands?
With the Rusty Nickel Band, we tend to be like an alternative rock band that sort of borrows occasionally. I mean, not on the record, but we have some new things. So it's kind of like alternative rock, but we try to sometimes experiment from different elements of pop. We used to be like Take Things As They Come is a very folky record, and we're not like that anymore. I play electric guitar and stuff, so we're definitely basing our material off like Americana and kind of alternative rock as it turned into indie rock in like 2000, you know, back when like Arcade Fire was like showing up, but they weren't like really big. And then when I play solo, it's just like a singer thing. It's just like a songwriter thing. It doesn't have the colorful solos and the mandolin and the awesome bass and any of that stuff. It's like just a guy and his guitar. So I guess indie folk Americana. I would love to say black metal, but that's not true.
So then what's next for you? What's coming up in the next 6 months?
Oh, there's so much going on. I mean, we're trying to finish our new Rusty Nickel EP. I'm trying to self-release that, maybe with a friend. We're doing a tour in July as Animals in Human Attire. I play bass with my friend Jack Tell and Alex and Nathan and Charlie. Charlie's in solo, so we're going on a tour in July. We're coming back in August, and me and my friends, our collective of friends that all play together, we're called Bread King. It's kind of like a name for your drinking group of friends. We're not like a label or anything, but we like to do events and stuff. We're doing a music festival from July 31st until August 3rd in River West, kind of like a bar hopping thing. So I've been setting that up. And then right after that, Temple is re-releasing our first record, The Conscience of the King, on vinyl. And we're doing like a four-week West Coast tour. And then I might be doing another tour right when I get back with another band, but I don't know if I can talk about that one yet.
So how do you juggle between the two bands? And because you're playing two different roles in each band.
Yeah. Well, right now, like, you know, as we make the Ladders record, Jordan from the Rusty Nickels and Jack, who's always a Rusty Nickel family member and also in Animals, they have their own project, the Lousy Trouts. They went on tour for like 2 weeks with the Ugly Brothers, which is our bass player. So half my band just went and did a tour with their bands. So while they're touring, we jump as Ladders really quick to go make a record really fast. And we got like 2 weeks to do this. We got to do it now because when the band comes back, we're like, we can't do this anymore. I plan around a lot of that. So yeah, you share. Everyone's got their own band. I'm just one of a lot of people.
Before we go, we have one last song we're going to hear from you, and it's called My Grandmother's House. And you touched a little bit on your grandmother's passing, but can you explain a little bit more about what we're going to be hearing and listening for in the song?
I guess at the time, you know, I lived right next door to my grandmother, and she had a house that everybody lived in. You know, I lived in there for like a few months when my mom was transitioning to the city to get ready with her job. So, you know, it's like a weird situation. You're kind of in your, you know, your relative has passed away, and you're kind of looking at all the photos of her being younger and this whole part of her life. It's her life's over, but it's all here right now. It's just like left over. I kind of sing about people ripping off the wallpaper. You know, you rip off the paper wall or the wallpaper and you got to put some new stuff up, you know. So I kind of hit on that a little bit. I hit on my mom. My mother was dealing with that experience a lot, you know, going through the house and cleaning all the boxes and stuff. So I was just trying to, like, let her know that I know what she's going through. You know, we're a family. We're together. The name lives on. Trying to go into a sad situation optimistically. You know, that's kind of what I'm trying to do.
Miles Coyne, thank you so much for being on WWM.
Thanks to you. Seriously, thank you so much.
Isn't it funny how the house is filled with photos of her younger self?
Miles Coyne is the leader of the Miles Coyne and the Rusty Nickel Band, and he's the drummer for the group Ladders. He's originally from Escanaba, Michigan, but now makes his home here in Milwaukee. The Rusty Nickel Band will be re-releasing their album Take Things As They Come on cassette tape in August, and they'll play at the Brady Street Festival on Saturday. Coyne spoke with Eleanor Peterson, and the full interview was originally aired on WUWM at night. And that's all the time we have today. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks again, as always, for tuning in. We're looking forward to having you join us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from listener-supported 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.
Miss Sunday Mass, the funeral, but don't blame me, 'cause I was in another state. She left behind a letter that's all.